This is the Creative Sports Podcast.
My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Karina Anglada.
Work, 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 work.
And Darius Thomas.
Yeah, it was dangerous. Leading a team within college athletics is no easy feat. But what if we told you there's actually a science behind it? Organization is the key. Today's guest, Kadeem Huggins, assistant AD for creative services at Tulane, knows all about the rigors of organized chaos. He's even found a solution that works for his team and might actually work for yours as well. So, as we continue to spotlight Black creatives in the sports industry during this month, take notes on how you can navigate through the day-to-day of being a creative in college athletics.
What's up? When I came in and saw the red light, I was like, you know, I almost texted you, but my call was wrapping up. So
what's going on?
Looking forward to the conversation.
Okay. 30.
What are you on right now?
25.
I waited because I was 2 seconds ahead. So I was trying to wait. And
We need an actual marker. I can't do this anymore. I can't.
Do you have an interest in adding motion design to your skill set, but just aren't sure where to start?
Let's go!
Welcome to Baller Effects, your source for sports content and motion tutorials. From tips and tricks to long-form tutorials and project deep dives, there's a lot to take in. There's even a free mini-course playlist called How to Animate Sports for Social. This playlist will take you step by step through the process of creating a 5-second animated player stat graphic. For your sport-specific motion training, visit BallerFX on YouTube and get started today.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Creative Sports Podcast. We're excited to be back for another episode. And today's guest is Kadeem Huggins, Assistant AD for Creative Services at Tulane University. Kadeem, welcome to the show.
What's going on? How y'all doing?
So as we get started today, kind of give us a brief history on how you got to where you are today.
Brief history. So if you want to start at, I was a video coordinator for Long Island University football team, where that was the X's and O's part of it. Through that, I was there maybe for 3 years. Then kind of went to my head coach, told him, you know, I kind of want to be on the sideline doing the creative aspects side of it. He said, Kadeem, I don't care. As long as I'm getting my game film, I'm happy. So I had to coach injured players how to. We didn't have managers. This is 2013, 14, whatever year that was. Kadeem, I don't care. But I had to teach injured players how to film up on the lift, up on the skybox, and make sure the film wasn't bad. So that was priority number one. I was able to go on the sideline. I was able to get $1,000 to buy my own camera off of Craigslist. This is out of New York. We met at a Starbucks, bought a Canon 7D with a 24-105 L series lens. Yeah. I still got it. And I was able to run from there. That was the beginning.
That's interesting. The evolution of, you know, Because when you just start, you need a camera to get your foot in the door, right? So you can learn. I remember trying to convince my wife to allow me to buy a 60D. So like the step below your 7D.
Could flip the monitor. The monitor, right?
And that was just when I had started working with the Bears. So it was about I took it to training camp. I remember ordering it, putting a hold on it at the post office so I could pick it up on my way down to training camp so it wouldn't come to the house when I had already left. And I started using it. And then over time, you start to understand why other people are upgrading to other equipment. So that's awesome that you got the equipment that you got when you got it at the rate that you got it so that you could learn from it and grow from it. So I guess what did you learn from that first camera and when you started getting on the sideline at with the team?
I didn't know what I was doing. That's the first thing I did learn. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't understand ISO. I learned broadcasting when I was in college. I learned editing on Final Cut X, Final Cut 7. When I first got my first Mac, Final Cut X came out. So it was just a whole bunch of jumping around and figuring things out. But I learned I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't understand how to balance light. I didn't understand I needed the filters. I just figured I had a high camera that I heard people were shooting music videos with, and I thought that I was the next best thing smoking. So you got humbled real quick. Then you take the time to learn. I think people, just like practice, you practice, right? And some people don't give up on practice, and some people continue to move forward. So I continue to move forward, and living in New York, you just have more opportunities to utilize your camera. I was doing music videos. I was doing events. I was shooting Sweet 16s. I was doing soccer matches on the side. So you just had ample amount of opportunity to work with the camera and still make a dollar.
How are you promoting yourself for all of that? Were you just telling everybody and anybody you knew about all of that? And then, you know, the other question I have is, you mentioned you learned real quick and you got humbled really quickly. What are some examples of some of that?
How did I promote myself? You're just outside, you know, you meet people, and you in the city, you play sports, you're going to meet people. And I think if you're not outside, you're not putting yourself in the best position. I think social media, and social media wasn't what it is today, obviously.
Yeah.
But you could still have the opportunity to network and talk to people. But I would just rather be outside and go to events and talk to people and see what they were doing. I had other like-minded creatives around me who did very similar things on camera, behind camera, editing. We jack of all trades. So what was the second question? I apologize.
No, you're good. I sort of separated them. The second question was, like you mentioned, getting humbled in your learning. Do you have any examples that you're willing to share with us?
Man, I could definitely send you everything. You know, I love YouTube because you could just go back and watch everything that you've added. But I have so much stuff on YouTube. It's crazy. But just understanding lighting and knowing, because you have this one setting, everything was. And I also didn't take the time to train myself at that point in time. I was just going out and shooting. I didn't do the YouTube research. I don't even know if YouTube was actually providing the knowledge that it does now. I love YouTube. It's my favorite platform. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't take the time. I didn't go to no beginner classes, but that was the life I lived. I never, even when I took my SAT, I went to one SAT prep class and I was like, all right, I'm good. You know? So through failure, you kind of learn, and I had to learn.
At what point did you realize this is what you really wanted to do, and, you know, get out of the coach's video coordinator role and then get into something a little bit more creative?
I love creating. I love being creative, but ultimately I love film and movies, I should say. And I think the opportunity that social media brought was the ability to combine different areas, industries. Like before, if you wanted to do film, you had to go to film school. You had to do this, that, and the third and understand whatever that mechanism was. Social media allowed me to create film in the sports world, in the fashion world. You know, I was able to put my touch and my own cinema eye, whatever it may be, onto something. So I think that's what brought me there. My love for film, but then the ability to be creative, be more cinematic, add music that I like, that the players like, that our fans liked. I think it just added just a different element that social media brought to us.
So you're at LIU as a video coordinator. What was the journey from there?
The journey from there, I'm going to shout out Kathleen Fox. She hates when I shout her out, but I always do because she provided me with the opportunities. But first, before her, I got to talk to my mentor, Craze. He started All Access DVD back in the day. That's when, you know, the Smack DVDs people talk about, and the French Montanas, I ain't gonna say the name, the CB4s and all that stuff, but he had those mixtapes out there. My mentor was the first one to actually come out with All Access DVD. And he taught me about content, right? And what that word means and how to play into the world of content. He brought me on tour. He put me in front of a lot of people. I was on tour with Method Man and Redman for a couple of dates, and they had a position open at New York City Tourism. And Kathleen Fox brought me in. I did a 3-month trial per se. And she told me, she's like, Kadeem, if you, and she was a big Wu-Tang fan, big Wu-Tang fan. And she said, Kadeem, if you're cool enough to be around Method Man and Redman, you're cool enough to be around us. And after my 3 months, they offered me the job. But within that, I had to learn. They gave me, I told you I was on Final Cut Pro. They say, hey, we want to give you a month to learn Adobe. And I learned it in 2 weeks. So, but Adobe is such more, Adobe is such a far, was such a far more user-friendly, not user-friendly. I think maybe Final Cut was more user-friendly because they had like the beginner tools in place, like the slipping that you can't, I don't think you can still do that in Adobe. The regular just dropping the clip and the clip automatically, it shifts over. But Adobe, just being able to put the different things on the screen, it was just such a more, going to Adobe Audition. Now, it was just so much more you could do with Adobe at the time that made it much more fun for me to learn. So I learned that in 2 weeks. And they saw the hard work I was putting in. I would never say no to going out on the field and shooting and editing and doing things. So I think I put in the work, but they saw something in me and we ran with it.
That's epic. I feel like the quote you said, if you're cool enough to hang around Method Man, Redman, like not many people have that ability or can say that. That's amazing. And I love that you took, you know, your different experiences to build on each of them. That's really cool. I do want to revisit something you mentioned, loving film. What's your favorite film or top three?
Top three, Bad Boys is one. Just culturally, that's just my thing. I used to watch Bad Boys every night before I went to sleep. Yeah, you know how people just put on Netflix now? We didn't have Netflix. So my thing, I had the movies I had on my PlayStation, and it was Friday. It was Bad Boys. It was, what's another movie here? Next Day Air, which don't get enough credit. It's a great movie. I just had those movies on my PlayStation. That's just what I used to put on at night to go to sleep to. And Bad Boys is just it for me. I'd hate to have these jump over because you love your legacies, but the Marvel movies, one of the greatest experiences I've had, and I've had a good bunch. One of the greatest experiences I had was going to opening night of Infinity War in Times Square. Mm-hmm. People were dressed up. It was a spectacle, but people were crying in the movies. It was a great experience. But those Marvel's movies, the way they put those together, the storytelling, the visual effects, they did their thing on that one. And I think just to put three, I would put anything Christopher Nolan makes. And I think he's top tier in anything he produces.
With that being said, do you draw inspiration from those type of films?
Yeah, I think if you look at any of my latest work as I'm still, you know, continuing to grow in my journey of cinematography, you will see a bunch of those shots that you will see from Christopher Nolan. Not even from Christopher Nolan. What's my guy named that produced Bad Boys? Oh, man, he produced Transformers and all these other things. Michael Bay. There's a shot with Michael and Will when they both stood up after he took them from in front of the yellow taxi cab when the young lady got kidnapped and they did the stand up and they had that pose. You will see those shots in a lot of my shots. I love the underhand, upper hand look. And I do this thing. A lot of other producers, when they see me do it, they kind of just say, oh, that's pretty creative. I use a monopod. I'm giving my jewels now. I do.
Yes. Yes. Sorry. Go ahead. I am team monopod all day. But
monopods
continue.
Are great.
I use the monopod and I flip it and I have it towards the ground and I have the camera facing up. And you can't see what you're really shooting unless you got a monitor, but I could kind of see what I'm doing and it gives you a different type of look. And I can kind of share some of those shots with y'all, but those shots are semi-based, inspired by Michael Bay, by Bad Boys, by that Martin and Will shot.
And so I'm chiming in here because I've done that, and one of the Sony reps that I worked with taught me exactly that. But I think for those who aren't as familiar, right, you secure your camera on top of a monopod, and then what, you flip it, literally flip the monopod and camera upside down, and then kind of hold it like it's a gimbal. Is that right?
Absolutely. I love a gimbal. We had a gimbal when I was working at tourism, but then I stopped using it because it was too perfect. It was too clean. It was too smooth. I love the shake. I love a little bit, not too much, but I love a nice shake. I like an authentic look.
The handheld, yeah, makes it, you know, natural.
Real natural, yeah. Especially working in sports. Like with a gimbal, you got to, you know, I don't know if people can see this, but you got to jam it. And I think with the hand, you could kind of just glide and stand up. I feel like it's so dangerous on a football field. These kids on the three sticks, and they're on the knee, and they can't move fast enough. I think being handheld, it allows you such more flexibility just to run around and move and do the things you got to do.
Yeah, it takes a real skill to do it, though. Like, everybody isn't very, you know, I don't trust myself handheld a lot just because I like to move a lot in an instance. But there's ways to get that out of the, like, Ronin line of the, not necessarily the old Ronin that's the, you know, the wide Steadicam, but like the Ronin R series. Like, you can take it and get as loose as you want or as tight as you want. So.
Yeah, I gotta learn. I hope I'm not stuck in my ways. I need that's
oh, no, good no.
Good. I need to learn. I need to learn more tools and stuff like that.
The reason that I remember, and this is an old story. I'm not gonna say his name, but he probably remembers this like it was yesterday. So, when I was at Ole Miss, and this may have been when I was, this is for sure when I was working there as an employee. We had a guy who was freelancing with us, and it was a football game. He always shot on a monopod, and a player came over and split the monopod in half. Like, the play came that way. And I was like, yeah, I'm never shooting football that close with a monopod. I'm like moving. It was dangerous.
It can be scary for sure. Even a hi-hat.
Yeah,
you know, you gotta know how to move.
Yeah,
like the first time I shot in it, I was scared. Like, and for football specifically, because I'm like, whether it's basketball, shoot, even cross country can be dangerous if they're, you know, coming across the finish line and they're out of it and they run into you, right? Like, you never know. So I think, being mobile, and I love, Kadeem, how you mentioned, right? Like that handheld look, it is something different. It kind of feels like you're there. And I think there is, I love hearing your perspective on that, because there is a time and place for having that, you know, crisp, perfectly framed, beautiful shot. But I think in sports, it is also refreshing to have that, like, you know, not perfect look too. So I love that perspective. Yeah. That's awesome.
I do love that. So we talked about gear a little bit. Let's ask, I know you talked about the 60D and some Canon stuff. What's been your kind of go-to camera and why?
So my camera to go to, I love Canon. I know Sony is kind of taking over the world with some of their stuff, but I love Canon. Justin is my favorite guy right now.
I've never liked the skin tones that Sony reproduced, and that's probably because of me. Not knowing how to adjust the camera as well, but I always felt like Canon gave me more true colors, but that's why I lean that way.
Canon has beautiful colors. I will tell anyone that I am a Sony user mostly, but I think that Canon honestly has the best natural colors coming straight out of the camera.
Sony has kind of greens, right? Like,
yeah.
I feel like skin tones.
I think
touch screen.
Yeah. Sony. And they do that on purpose for some reason. And Sony users know how to kind of adjust to it. And I think it's with some of the, like LUTs and all that, it's a reason that they lean more into that green space. If you go to Canon, it's probably a more, you know, a warmer touch in that color science. But it would be great to get some of those guys on an episode to talk down that road. But I also have a story behind why I stopped using Canon back in the day, is because Sony, as you know, like right around in that time where you're talking about, like in 2013 or 14, I was at Georgia, and Sony was coming out. Well, they already had the FS700 that was shooting slow-mo.
I loved that camera.
And then they came out with some other stuff, but that's when they came out with the A7S, and you could, you know, shoot some slow-mo, and Canon refused to step into that space. So I was like, peace. But shout out to Canon, shout out to Sony, shout out to all of the camera brands. Every camera.
Shout out to Canon.
Shout out to Fuji.
Fuji just showed us some love. I'm going to shout out to Fuji for sure.
Yeah, we love Fuji. I think, well, here's the thing. Ultimately, it's A, what you have at your disposal, I think, especially in sports, right? Sometimes you don't have the ability to choose. Maybe you inherited something that a previous manager, boss, supervisor, whatever had. But I think the most important thing, and I think, Kadeem, you kind of echoed this, right, is like setting aside that time to learn, that maybe you didn't do that first part of your career, which I think a lot of us are in that same boat. We just kind of like jumped in, not worrying how, do we know how to swim? I don't know. We'll figure it out as we go. But I think
just survive.
You know, yeah, just survive and learn and evolve. And, you know, for all we know, years down the road, it might be another camera company that, you know, starts to become the main one. But I love the gear talk. It's always fun hearing what people are using.
Yeah. And every camera has its own thing. And I think, users kind of fall into what they want. You know, there are a number of people who started switching over to Sony, and then realized that they really love Canon and, you know, sold off their stuff. And, you know, it doesn't really matter which camera you have. It's, at the end of the day, it comes down to, do you know how to use a camera? Do you know how to make the most out of the camera that you are given or put in your hand? So let's talk Tulane.
I think I cut him off to start that whole.
Did we answer the question?
Yeah, no, he was in the middle of talking about the equipment that you had asked him. So go back to that.
I can answer that. Oh yeah, so equipment I would buy is a Canon. Like Karina said, on my own, Karina said, I came into Tulane and they kind of had a bunch of Sony cameras already. So I don't want to be that guy. But when I had the opportunity at the Mid-American Conference to really buy my own equipment, the first camera I bought was a Canon C200. We used a Canon C100 when I was in tourism, and I was like, this camera is dope. And back to your point of having handheld, that camera was a little bit heavier, so that you were able to be a little more steady with it, because it just added some more weight to it. It just had more weight to it. So, but if you gave me $10,000 today, I might go back to a Canon C2, C3, wherever they're at now.
Wow.
I think they have a C600 now, I believe.
And give it to me.
But it's not going to be $10,000. Okay.
I like that. Yeah, 10,000. Like, give me a quick hitting. Like, what's in your cart immediately? Like, you're starting from scratch. You got 10K. I'm gonna give you like 20 seconds. Starting 3, 2, 1, go. What's in your cart?
Give me 10K. It's not that much no more.
How about 15? Go 15.
Yeah,
15. We'll give you a little bit more.
I'll definitely go with probably a Canon C200 just because I know that's reliable. And give me prime lenses. I want a 50. I want an 85. And I'll give me one zoom. Give me one zoom just to have it. But
what would be your go-to zoom? Price doesn't matter. Like, what would be like
that's
your...
hard.
It is. Right now we have
good
a
starter range.
We have a Tamron 24-150, I think it is. I could be lying to you.
35-150.
35-150, but that camera is, that lens is
amazing. It's heavy.
Do you have any servo zooms or like Senna zooms, or do you just use the portrait or the photography style lenses?
Photography style.
That's how.
All right, we cut his time.
We did cut his time. We cut his time. That's a fun question, though.
That is, and I think we should add that into, because I like how you jump to the 50, the 85,
the prime lenses,
a zoom.
Yeah.
Because when people started making that switch into the more cinematic style, some people ran from, wanting a set lens. Yeah. And some people, I was probably one of those that was kind of like half and half, because I was so used to like more of a broadcast handheld, with a servo zoom, because you could do a little bit more, but you couldn't get as creative with the servo zooms. But there are, speaking of Fuji, like they do have that line of Cabrios and the MX or MK lenses that, kind of put you in that. It's kind of photo, but then it's got the video capabilities, just not without the servo, unless you spend the extra cash. But yeah,
I think those primes just give you that depth too, mm-hmm. that you just don't get. I guess you could get them with the zooms, but then I know a lot of cameras now, they have the locked in ISO or the locked in whatever it is called now. I can't remember, but before, if you zoomed in on a lens, it would just take down all of your settings and it would just change everything, at least on the cameras I was working on. Yep. So the prime, you would just have more security. And then you can use why the Canon C200s were also always so good, because they had the built-in ND filters.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So that was amazing. That was a game changer.
Right.
And audio.
Yeah.
That was a game changer.
Yeah, which takes me back to the Sony is one reason because you could do 120 and still get audio on the DSLRs back in the day.
Yeah.
But
so if you just listed off a couple different kinds of lenses, you've talked about using a monopod upside down. How do you use those lenses in a game? So if you go out to a game, are you're taking one camera with you? Do you have another one on the sideline that you can change out quickly? What does that setup look like for you as you're shooting a game, and how do you think about which lenses you're using in which situations?
I mostly use the 50, or I mostly use a prime lens for pregame. When I'm on the court, I'm primarily I know we ain't touching Tulane yet, but I'm the primary content producer for Tulane's men's basketball. So when I'm on the court, I am using a prime lens just to get that nice little cinematic look. And then once the game starts, I switch to a zoom lens, but then it depends on how I feel. I might go back to a prime and sit baseline or courtside or sit in the stands just to have a nice stagnation. I like to switch it up. I don't like to do the same thing. If you see me at any basketball game, I'm never sitting in the same spot. I know they give you the baseline seating. You got to cross your legs and all. I might be at the top of the rafters. I might be an empty seat in row 15, I might go sit there. So I like to jump around and just switch it up from time to time. I get bored.
Are you the only person, let's say for home games, I assume for road games, it's probably just you, but kind of what's the setup for home basketball?
A home basketball game, we have a secondary primary, but at a mid-major, you kind of don't have all those resources in place. So I try to manage the team's bandwidth a little bit better. So if we have, like, we just played Memphis. They were number 10 in the nation. We had four producers. But at a home game where the fans may not show up in abundance, or it just might be a easier game, a game I can manage on my own. I'm comfortable managing that on my own. It depends. It really depends.
When you move from one spot to another, what is influencing you to move? Do you see something and you go, or you're just like, you have a sense? Like, for people that are shooting or learning to shoot you know, game mm-hmm. action specifically, what tips do you have for them in those making those decisions?
One, I just feel like I'm in this section, in this spot for too long. And to me, if you're trying to tell a story, you need to diversify your shots. Mm-hmm. The greatest compliment, they don't know it. Last year we was at a basketball tournament. They said, Kadeem, we can't find you. We was looking for you. You wasn't there. You wasn't. I'm like, thank you. Cause I don't want to be in the same spot ever. For me to tell a story, for me to be able to diversify my shots, I need to move around. And it keeps me active. It keeps me from going into a hall of boredom. Especially once you get into basketball, you kind of run into set plays and people are in the same location at all times. I know who's going to be in this corner pocket at all times. That's going to be number 7. I know who's going to be driving and dumping the ball. That's going to be number 12. So just to diversify your shots. I know some producers who don't shoot defense. I go shoot defense as well because I think you get more of a – I've seen it. I saw the face cavity. I've seen it. I go actually at the beginning of a game, I start off on the our defensive side just so I could get those shots. But I think you get more a lot of opportunity. I'm just a storyteller at the end of the day. Going back to my film and movies, like I lean into that a lot.
Yeah.
That was a perfect setup for what I was gonna ask Karina.
Oh, nice.
What is your output? What are you shooting for? What is your ultimate goal at the end of the game? Is your goal to put together more of a storytelling recap? Is it more about the highlights? What does that look like for the team since you work specifically with men's basketball?
Yeah, for me, so this, I've had this conversation with a few people, and I don't know if it's controversial or not, but I don't like recaps. I think recaps are not a good use of time, especially once you get into what are you producing and who you're working for. So for me, and because I worked in that tourism space, I kind of have a better sense of the marketing side of it and how are we using content. So I would much rather, especially what today's social media is, like it's not the 20-minute long YouTube videos like it used to be in 2014. In today's world, you get much further with 15 to 30 seconds. So if I just put out some isolated clips after a game, one, that would keep our student athletes happy because they're still getting content. That would keep our fans happy because they're still seeing what it is. We're not being dictated by wins and losses because a recap, you could have 5-20 season. How many recaps can you really put out? But if a player dunks on somebody, that clip still might go viral, quote unquote, but you still have that opportunity to still distribute content. Recaps, I like to use more promotional. Going back into movies and films, you don't really see a trailer of a movie after the movie is out. You see it before because it's promoting, it's selling something. I think that lends to better usage of time, bandwidth. And really, if you're really trying to make your employer happy, well, we sold 20 tickets off this preview of a game, this highlight, this intro of a game compared to a recap where we just put together our best highlights with a broadcast audio over under it.
Yeah. And I think it depends on what you're looking for too. Cause I do agree. I think that highlights in the way that we are accustomed to them really, I mean, who's watching them? Who everybody can see it on television. Now, if you have a TV deal as a conference, they can put together, you know, the highlights. But you can also, if you get a big win, let's say that, you know, Tulane beats Memphis, a lot of people are leaning into, and now Karina's really going to perk up with the mini movies because the Warriors were very heavy in that, especially during the finals. There's a way to tell the story, win, lose, or draw, and people will still, you know, lean into that. So I think planning to do one every week isn't, or after every game, isn't a very good use of time and resources. But now that, you know, people are needing footage for intro videos and social videos and, you know, one-off clips. Yeah, you need content. I worked for a school, and I won't name which one, that definitely did not believe in using anything from a game that they lost. And it's like, you can't do that. Cause like people know that you lost and they know where, like, right. But are you, if you lose three games in a row, are you not going to update your intro or, you know, walkout video or any of that? So I think that wins and losses should definitely not dictate when you're going to do content.
No, I agree. And you brought up, that's a great point as well of, you know, the major wins. Like when we beat Memphis, you had that mini movie, you called it, out the next day, because that is a major win. They stormed the court, the fans, and, you know, it was a moment. It was a moment, but not every win is a moment. And right. I think managing bandwidth is very, very, especially today. I hope we get to talk about bandwidth and all that stuff later on.
Yeah, because I think with, you know, going back to a Memphis win, it's like you can put out that moment the next day. Put it, let's say you have four people covering the game. Everyone sees the game from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And so you're putting those four perspectives and not just saying, oh, well, here's how the game started from start to finish. There may be a fire pregame speech. But what if you don't, you know, what if you're not playing Memphis? How can you still take advantage of some of those moments that still may happen? It just may be in more of an isolated way. I think that as departments, sometimes we get so driven in, hey, we got to do this the exact same way every single time.
The checkbox.
Oh, we got to have six highlights after the game so that the players are happy. It's like, what's going to be best for our program? Like, we got to recruit players. We got to, you know, attrition, keep that down. Like, it's a lot of things that we have to consider. And at the end of the day, what's important to us as a whole. So we talked pre-show about AI. How are you incorporating AI? Like, how is that affecting you, yourself, and your department? And what do you like or dislike about it?
How do I incorporate it? I utilize it to fast track a lot of my processes. Typing up an email, I will still write it myself because I'm capable of writing.
Yep.
But I might use an AI just to clean it up or reword it. I may use AI and to automate emails, which is still AI, still automation. I might use AI to, I just started doing it for text messages, really and truly. If I think about, I don't know how many other people are, I'm a night owl. I will go to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning. I've been trying to stop, but for some reason the juices are going.
Same.
I got to text somebody this. And now I just schedule it to go out at 10:15.
What are you using to schedule, though?
Yeah. Whoa. How are you doing that? Because I need to know. Yeah.
They have the app is called like Shortcut, and it's built into the iPhone if you're an iPhone user. And you go to Shortcuts, and they have the automations down at the bottom in the middle column. And you could just kind of schedule yourself out.
I am the exact same way. Night owl, and I'll look at my text messages and it's 3 a.m. and I think I did it to you, Justin, yesterday. It was like, I realized after I sent it, I'm like, crap, it is so late right now. And I am that asshole, that person that sending stuff.
Or that.
I put my phone on silence, but if you text me at early hours of the morning, I will probably get back to you at like 6:30. So it'd be a return favor. When I wake up, especially being on the East Coast.
That's a good tip. I like that. I'm searching it as we're chatting here.
So for your staff, like, how are you using it? And like, are there certain apps and stuff that are AI generated that kind of help you with scheduling, with kind of planning stuff out? I know you talked about drafting emails and all that, but like, what are you leaning into there?
So right now, since I've been at Tulane, I've implemented Airtable, which is somewhat of in layman's terms, project management, but it's much, much stronger than that to me.
There's a lot you can do with Airtable too.
It's
almost too much.
Yeah. I use it for the content development. I use it for project management. I use it for delegation of work. I use it for a lot. It's really a game changer in the eyes of what we do here at Tulane right now. And I'm going to talk to you about the automations, but right now We are tracking over, we fully implemented it in May of 2023. Right now we are over 1,500 projects submitted, and those are people making requests to us. Wow. With well over 2,600 deliverables, creative deliverables. So the ability to track that, see that, especially in today's age with social media, that people want 20,000 things out, is such a strong tool for us to be able to do that. And we travel, and we shoot the games, and we're producing it. So it's just, it's a great tool for us.
Are you using that? Are you using that to ladder up to your AD or your boss and be like, hey, this is why we need more help and support. This is, you know, let me show you the exact numbers of people making requests that we're delivering on, or how are you using that?
That's a big part of it, is being able to show and tell the workload, be able to manage, going back to managing bandwidth. You know, we can't continue to go down this path. We're averaging 126 projects a month. How are we able to scale back or hire up, or at least be able to hire freelancers, consultants, whatever that may be, so we could produce, because we still want to produce. I think that's where college gets you, is that you fall in love with the student athletes, and you want to be around them, and they get you, and they get Trap. You, and they get you, and you still want to produce, right? And but the student athletes, they want, you know, personalized highlight tapes after games, and we can't do that. So being able to talk to our admins and say, hey, this is our workload. And I sit in on our senior staff meetings, and that's the first thing I ring off is, it depends on which number is the most prettiest. I started off with 1,000 creative deliverables. Now I'm leading off with, hey, we're averaging 126 projects a month. You know, so they really get a real scale of what we're doing, because they don't know our process. They don't know how much footage. They don't know I go home with 340 something video clips to go through at night to then log, to then make selects, to then put together fine music, to then put together a video that I hate the next day. You know, they don't get that. So I think having those, that system in place allows us to tell the story.
What are you using for logging?
Logging right now, it's really handheld. When I was at, Tourism, we was using CatDV. Right now at Tulane, we're not really using anything. We just use our server. They log the name of the people, Forbes, 7-3, fan shots, and then they put it in. That's a system I walked into. Can't fight every battle, day one.
Yeah. Well, that's a big opportunity for AI right there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
If you knew any, please let me know.
Yeah. I think in the sports world, especially in college, and probably especially on your level, I mean, that's something that nobody has really figured out the perfect sauce for.
No, I mean, even we have influencer where they have the auto AI tagging for some pieces, but you know, once you get into football, you have 15 different jerseys, including the refs, including the fan mm-hmm. who has on a different jersey. It's reading all of that, so it can't read anything. So we just do it manually ourselves. So I think as time goes by, it'll probably own in. Maybe have a select tool. Influencer, create a select tool. We could just click on a player, and then it's just going to read that. And we'll be great and fine and dandy.
You mentioned tagging and server. What are you using for server?
Internal server, campus server. That's really it. We can use hard drives, external hard drives for the most part, run and gun. But then once we're done with that, we backlog it on our server. And then we also use Box as a online server.
Gotcha.
Seems like you have a lot to balance. You know, you mentioned being in senior staff meetings. You're on the road and, you know, doing home games and everything in between with men's basketball. my fake New York almost came out. How do you balance all of this in the schedule? And it sounds like you're also managing, and you know, I've heard you mention multiple times during this, you want to take care of the bandwidth of your team and the people that you're working with. How do you balance all of that? Because I think that's one thing that I thought about for a long time when I was still in sports, of like, I love being around the student athletes and connected and like physically there, but then thinking about that next step of management and growing in my career. How do you balance everything that you're doing?
It's tough. It's tough. I'm not going to lie to you. I will say the best thing has been Airtable. Being able to just not have to ask, what are you working on? I can now see it without even having to ask you, or I could cancel this meeting because I know that project is done. And I always talk about this tourism, and for some reason, I just learned so much there. And they had physical project managers, which I have not seen a university really have that yet. And I worked for a conference office, and I ran around a lot, and I met a lot of people, and they all run into the same thing of management and time life and work life, whatever that may be. When I was at tourism, they had project managers who would have 15-minute powwows in the hallway and be like, Kadeem, what you need for this video? I need graphics. A graphic designer had this. Everything was separated. So I see the vision. I see what it could be. Airtable has been a great deal, has been a great help, because I'm just able to get back time. I don't have to chase nobody. I know where things are. And I think that's the biggest thing, is that once I'm able to see what's going on, I'm able to keep us at bay. I'm able to keep the people that requested graphics at bay. And I know I can tell you about the automations. Once you submit a request, it comes to us. We get an email every morning at 8:15 saying what projects were submitted the day before. Once somebody assigns themselves to your project, you get that email. So now you know who's working on your project. Y'all can have back and forth discussions. Then once it's time for review, the member of the staff will put it in box. We upload the box link to Airtable, put ready for review. You get another email. So it eliminates a lot of conversation lost than walking in the hallway, text, email. I've had, and not here at Tulane, multiple places where you have the same conversation in three different avenues, and you can't work like that, can't live like that. So our staff here, I tell, hey, have that conversation with them in the hallway, but follow up with them as soon as you get back to their desk. Hey, fill out this form outlining that conversation we had. Like, help me help you. And I think that's how I'm able to really and truly manage, is just taking all that risk and all of that work. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work that you kind of just delegate and get rid of.
Yeah. You talked about, possibly using, freelancers, and, when your staff is kind of bogged down. Let's talk about freelance from two different lanes. Like, how often are you bringing in, freelancers or consultants, and how often are you yourself or your staff kind of leaning into freelance?
How often do we bring in? It depends on the work. I would love to get to a place where we have campaigns and we're able to bring in a freelancer to kind of do the work on campaigns, where those are long term or whatever it may be, but just special campaigns. I think if our workers are able to just continue to focus on the day to day projects and stuff like that, and the campaigns are being managed outside, it will still give us that time back where we don't have to worry so much, I would say. For me, I will say leaning into freelance, I kind of want the creative team to do that. I think the ability to continue to still go out there and learn different ways of working, I'll tell you this. When I was working at tourism, you can name that the title. When I was working at tourism, we had a producer and she was a real producer, the one that would do all the checks in the boxes and call people and book locations and things like that. She went to go work on Gordon Ramsay's show in Denver, Colorado. And I was like, why? Why did y'all let? She was going for like 2 weeks. I'm like, why did y'all do that? Oh, because she would be able to go there, pick up some tips and some tricks, and bring that back to us. And now we are better because of that. And I thought that was the greatest thing I ever heard in my life. So from there, you got to go out and you got to explore and you got to continue to navigate what is life. Because you don't know. People want to work in sports because they see it. It's exciting. Don't get me wrong. But what else is out there? What else are you able to learn from? Where can you lean into? When I played football, I did, what's the word? What did I do? I did boxing off train. I did kickboxing. I did wrestling for a little bit. Because you have to do other things to make that first avenue better. And I think leaning into the freelancing world, you get to do that and still make a dollar, an extra dollar.
Yeah, and you also mentioned before we got started that you're freelance, you choose to not do it in sports. Can you kind of talk about the value of doing freelance work outside of sport and how that helps you do your day to day?
Yeah, I love to tap into other industries because you just get to learn different ways of working. I think in sports, and I think sports might have the highest caliber of outgoing. I don't know too many other people that have as much outgoing, but if you go to a car dealership and they showcasing all the brand new cars that they have, you get to show the value of, okay, I'm making this video because it will sell. It will sell this product. And I think once you get a grasp of the content you're producing does have a meaning behind it, I think you understand the value that you're bringing to the table. I think creatives are super undervalued, going back to Airtable, it shows that value in what we do and who's producing that this high clip. I think just being able to show and see a value is so important. And social media is so new. I would say probably less than 10 years old as far as the marketing, the strong marketing side of what social media is. But everybody could do it. They got cell phones. I could take this picture and put it out. Well, it's a little bit different. It's a little more intertwined things that you don't know, and audio and video, blah, 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 blah. But I think going to outside of just sports, you really, really get to understand your value.
All right. This is where the show turns.
Let's go.
Wait, I have to chime in because okay. I missed a segue. And maybe we can edit it. But Kadeem, earlier you said it's work. And I was about to start singing. Work. Because, you know, Rihanna reminded me of Rihanna. And one of the questions we asked you is, you know, what could we find out about you ahead of time that we might not know? And one of the things you mentioned was Caribbean culture. So I had to mention my girl Riri. So share with us about your Caribbean culture. What is your background? Mm-hmm. Where is home originally? All those things.
So home originally, I was born in the Bronx, but my family is from the Virgin Islands. I was born maybe in New York for 5 years, and then we went to the Virgin Islands, and I went to school there for the next 7-8 years. And it's just a different type of feel. It's home, and it's just different, man. And you know, growing up too, being a professional in any industry, being a black man in a profession, being a black person in any profession as a professional, you don't see yourself a lot. Mm. When I'm in the Virgin Islands, I see me a lot, and I see a lot of entrepreneurs. And I see, and I, this might lend into why in New York was such an easy navigation for me, because I seen the hustlers in St. Thomas selling the coconuts on the road, but I also not just see them doing that work. I also seen them with being lawyers. If you're going from island to island, if you're going to a different island in the British Virgin Islands where my grandparents live, a small island called Anegada, we had black pilots, and they were father and son, you know? So I saw all of that. Coming to America, moving to Cleveland, you don't see that. New Orleans, you see it a lot. But once you leave out of here, and it's New Orleans, once you move out of New Orleans, you don't see it as much. So the further I get away, the more grateful I am that I was able to grow up in the islands and just see black ingenuity and people prospering. And still having the same troubles. You're still having to, you know, staying up later because you have to do your books and whatever that may be. You still have that, but it was able to see it, and it still makes me happy to this day.
Yeah, and that's, I'm glad that she, that Karina segued that way, because I was going to go to the food. Obviously, we know about we hear about or we've experienced it ourselves, the beautiful food that is Caribbean food. But you also live in a really rich food culture in New Orleans. So talk about both. What do you love about each one? And which is your favorite?
Man, don't hate me at home, but New Orleans food, man, it don't get no better. I have not had anything better than the food out here. It is, no matter where you go, hole in the wall, gas station, corner store, five star, one star, it's all good. I've not had one bad piece of dish since I've been here. It's the food down here is just something else, man. And then there's all these festivals and the food trucks, and you could try the mac and cheese with the crawfish with the, you know, and then, hey, let me go get a po' boy. And just, let me get a lobster today, and let me get crab tomorrow and gator the next. And it's just different down here. And the food down here is amazing. You got to watch yourself because you could blow up real fast.
Yeah, just ask a certain basketball player whose name will not be mentioned in New Orleans.
Darius, I had to go there.
But talk about that Caribbean culture and food and like why it's important to like remember those kind of roots as well.
I could tell you another reason why I love New Orleans, because it culture is very similar to mine, Caribbean culture, even though it's completely different. But their Mardi Gras is my carnival. They dress up, we dress up. They have their colors, we have our colors. It's all about the culture and continuing with the heritage that was set before you. And I think that's so important. So when you go into the food, you're still getting that old school cooking. There's no fusion. There's not much of a this mixed with this and that. It's homegrown. It's grandma cooking. It's just home. It feels like home. It tastes like home. It's satisfying. It puts you to sleep. You know what that word is. You know, so it does that to you, and you just it just feels, I don't know, it just feels good. It feels good to have a nice home meal. We have a kid on our team, on our staff. I humbug him all the time. I don't know if humbug's a real word, but that's the word we use in St. Thomas.
It's used.
We humbugging all the time because his grandmother live in Lafayette, which they say is the home of Cajun food. And they talk down upon New Orleans. Hopefully, I don't get on me too much. But they talk down upon New Orleans because they say it's not real Cajun food. So we got to go to you. Like, that's where I'm at now. I'm ready to travel a couple hours and get some food.
Yeah, I've heard that. And I even had a guy that I, he worked at a company that I was contracting with. And he's from New Orleans. And he himself said that Lafayette has the best food. I have never experienced it, but I am willing to make that trip and find out.
I'm willing. And it's Mardi Gras season now, so I might as well just go now when people are super, super happy and just want to give food away.
This is making me really hungry and also jealous right now.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking about a pasta dish I had when I was there in New Orleans, and it was amazing. It was really good.
Yeah,
it's such a great city, food city, music city, everything culturally.
Everything.
Love it, and all the influence, right? Of all the things but I can get off topic. I love that. That's awesome. And we tell us when you go to Lafayette because I want a road trip.
That sounds like a food show and a podcast episode on just food, brought to you by.
Yeah, let's do it.
Tourism.
Yes, there it is. Drink every time tourism is mentioned on this podcast. Just kidding. Don't encourage.
Yeah, we don't. You actually had a question and Justin actually kind of fits into this as well. You had a question for Karina and I before we got started about, you know, the changing landscape of creatives and the industry that we've all, you know, spent quite some time in.
Yeah. My question is, you know, a lot of people are working in sports, no matter the avenue, whether it's professional, collegiate, tend to leave and just go on their own freelancing, creating their own entrepreneurial endeavors. I'm curious to know why that is, because a lot of people get to the highs of the highs. They get to the Alabamas, they get to the Ohio States, they get to wherever they want to be, but then still not, maybe still not satisfied. Or maybe they realize there's more, once again, back to the value, more value in what I do that's not really being calculated here. So I'm curious to know, what was y'all's decisions to go freelance or solo?
Krenny, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. I think for me, you know, I'll chat about the move from collegiate athletics to pro, and then now I'm in tech. But for me, people don't believe me when I say this. I did not want to leave working for Auburn University. I had a really hard time thinking about making the transition. And for me, I had started my big girl career working for pro basketball, you know, in the NBA. And then I went to Auburn University, and then I went to the NBA again. But for me, I was really happy working at the university level. I loved working with student athletes. I felt like, you know, we could do more. I could be more creative. I could connect with people that were, you know, closer-ish to my age. There were less rules around, you know, collective bargaining, and you can't use this sponsor because it's a competitor with that sponsor. And I just felt like I could be more creative. And for me, what ultimately led me to the move was I at least to the Warriors, was if I didn't, I might regret it. And I didn't want to ever question regretting it. So I made that jump. And now, you know, working in tech in a very similar space, but different, one of the biggest things was, if I'm being completely candid, was finances, right? And hours and work-life balance. I do have a much better work-life balance in my current situation, in the sense that I have much more control over my schedule. Whereas you guys know, if you work in sports, you're at the mercy of the schedule you work for, right? Whether that's tournament play, playoffs, postseason, all of that. So I think the one trend that I've seen, and the reason I think a lot of people are making that shift towards freelance, is money, right? They're seeing, oh, I could maybe charge this amount and pay myself for everything, and I have maybe full creative control, or more creative control than I might, you know, having to work with an AD or, you know, whoever is on your team. So I think that's one thing. But the one thing I will say about it, and this might be a hot take, I think the freelance video market is becoming oversaturated, especially in sports. Like, there's so many people that are making that decision saying, I'm leaving, I'm doing my own thing, I'm starting my own production company. And we said it earlier in this call, it's really hard. And you kind of, you don't know about something until you do it, until you experience it. And we said it as a unit earlier in this call, like, we didn't know what we weren't doing until we learned the hard way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's my take. I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I still have the 9-to-5. So I'll throw it over to Justin and Darius, because y'all are in it. But that's my take. That's my hot take. But I'm gonna throw it over to y'all.
I'll go last.
I want to hear what you have to say. Justin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So I agree with that. I think for me, so when I left Chicago, I came to Boston because my wife grew up here, and we started a family. So that move was about being closer to family for support, because working in sports, you work a lot. I think I worked 6 or 7 out of like 10 Christmas days, which is tough when you have a young family.
It's tough.
But I think in general for me, I kind of got to the point where I was quote unquote running a video production team, but I had a boss that didn't understand what we did, and his whole goal was to scale us. And as you guys know, trying to scale creative doesn't work that well, because creative's different. There's some things you can scale, and, you know, whether that's your production pipeline and some of that kind of stuff. But it got to the point where I was reporting to people who had no idea what we were doing, yet they wanted to make all the decisions. And I got tired of it. And so I decided I was going to leave. I got hired at Dapper Labs for NFL All Day and got laid off and got a horrible severance. 1 month of pay and 1 month of health insurance. So that lit a fire under my ass to say, I'm doing this myself. I'm going to go out and this is the best opportunity for me to do it. I would say that I spent the previous three to four years prepping myself for that, though. I had thought about going freelance and jumping out. So I had done all the work. I had started my YouTube channel just to try and share. And while I was still full time, trying to help other people get into the industry. So a lot of people found me that way. And so I think that was super helpful for me to have done it. But I think it was the business side of things. I mean, if people talk about these big name teams, and my take on that, having worked for the Chicago Bears and the Boston Celtics, is that the bigger name teams, quote unquote, are the worst ones to work for, to be honest with you. I'm just going to say that because
the tea is piping hot. Oh my goodness.
Boom. They have so much history.
It's hard to work against that because
everything is it's how we've always done it. It's everything's a fight. Everything's an argument. Everything's a, well, we've never done it that way before, and very stuck in their ways. And I love what they're starting to do now. You see some stuff. I think a lot of the content that's being shared is from an intern who's there that they're letting run and create. I'm like, my God, like, this is all stuff that we've been fighting for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to see that. I'd still, you know, obviously have friends that work there and good with the people there. But I think that so often we put teams on pedestals that just doesn't, it's not the same. It's, you don't go to a place like that and have your voice heard. You go to a place like that and get told what sales sold and what you get to do while they outsource everything, because there's also a risk factor internally, whether it's for the people who are heading up these departments. They want to offload the risk so they can just tell somebody, well, I'll fire that group and I'll go hire somebody else. Whereas if you're doing it internally, that's everybody's ass on the line. And the risk factor of that is super high. And I don't think people understand that enough. So now on the outside, being my own person, I get to work with people in better capacities that are more aligned with my skill set and are areas that I can help them do the work that they either don't have the expertise internally or don't have the bandwidth internally to do. So, I hope that kind of answers your question. But I think a lot of people build up things to be bigger and better than they actually are, because that hasn't been my experience having worked in a place like that.
Brand names matter, but they don't at the same time. Like, that's kind of what I realized. Like, I anytime I mention Golden State Warriors, yes, people's ears perk up, no doubt about it. That does matter. But I think what my advice to any creative or any person listening, you have to work for an organization that is right for you at the end of the day. And sometimes you don't know if it's right for you until you get there, right? So you have to take that risk. But sometimes the brand name isn't all that it's meant to be in the day-to-day work, just because, like Justin said, there's a lot of different, you know, moving parts that are affecting what your output can be. So that's just my advice. But Darius, I'm curious.
I think
this
two
is a great
of you,
question, Kadeem, by the way.
Yeah, the two of you really like hit it on the head, and I don't have a whole lot to add to those reasons other than, one, I didn't really choose it. It chose me due to some COVID cuts. And, you know, I knew that eventually I wanted to work in a different workspace, per se. Like, you know, I loved working in college athletics. I spent a lot of time, sacrificed a lot of things, you know, birthdays and events and trips and this and that, would not trade any of it for the world. I worked with some of the mm-hmm. best athletes that have ever touched, you know, the water, that have ever touched, you know, a football, a basketball, a baseball. I would not trade that. However, when you yeah. start to get older in age, like I never could have, would have done it at 23, 24, like, oh, I'm just going to go freelance full time. First of all, I don't know anything yet. Like I didn't know anything. Like I had connections. Like I've always had connections no matter where I was, but this is getting into the advice side. Is like, if you think that there's a possibility that you want to, you know, go into a different industry, whether it's, you know, going from college to pro sports or going from working in sports to working for an agency, have conversations with someone, not, hey, can you give me a job? Or, hey, how do you, I was just having a conversation with somebody yesterday. It was like the value of asking the right questions to get the answers that you need, not how did you get there? Like, hey, I want to be the CEO one day. How do I get there? It's like, no, what challenges did you face? Like, was it worth it? Was your journey worth it? Would you do it over again? And that's when you get to the real meat of the reasons of why people do what they do. I think we're in a space right now where people really value themselves individually and in some cases put themselves and their personal brand over. Like, if you want to be your own personal brand, do that. There's nothing wrong with personal branding. We just had an episode on personal branding. However, if you work for a team, you have to also understand that when you walk through those doors and you put on that logo, they pay you. It may not be what you have self-worth, you know, put on yourself.
Yeah.
But you work for them. You work for that brand. And there's nothing wrong with working for a brand. I worked for, you know, three really great brands in my mind. And I wouldn't change it for anything. But I think that mm-hmm. sometimes we, you know, we want to get somewhere too fast. And it's not just saying, oh, just stay somewhere and just take everything. No, I'm not saying that at all. Sometimes you have to learn where you are when you're there and put that in a toolbox to say, okay, well, if I'm the lowest on the totem pole, instead of me getting mad about I'm not getting paid enough for this, I'm not doing this, whatever, whatever, learn what you can there. Have conversations with people around you because that can help you on the other side, whether it's the next job, whether it's 5 years down the line when you're running your own agency. And also, do you want to be a frereelancer or do you want like a full-time freelancer or do you want to be a business owner? Because those are two different things. Like you work in the business or you work on the business and you can do both, but can you work on the business at a high level to get to where you want? Because there are a lot of talented people. Way more talented than I am, maybe more talented than Justin and Karina and yourself. But do they have the other things that can separate them from just being talent to then being a business owner? So with that being said, hopefully I didn't ramble too much. My last question, because I have another call coming up. What advice would you give to aspiring creators or creatives who want to be like you in the space, whether that's, you know, being a black man or a black person, as you said, you know, when we were talking about, you know, culturally where you came from, aspiring people who want to see themselves in positions like you have?
I would say exactly what you just said of understanding who you are, understanding what you bring to the table. I think that is so important. When you go places and at one point I stopped and said, I do not care to be the best videographer anymore. At one point, I knew who Darius was before we got on this call because his name rang bells, right? He worked at Tech, but he had those names attached to him. Like you said, Karina, he had those names attached to him. So when people talked about certain things, it was look at what was going on over here, look at what was going on over there. do not get attached to a brand. Mm-hmm. You need to understand what you're going to get out of that brand. And you could have the grandest time of your life. Have a great time. Have an amazing, have the time of your life. I just went to China with Tulane men's basketball, representing Team USA in the University World Games. Amazing. Opening ceremony is something I'll never forget. Insane. Great moment in my life. Mm-hmm. But I know what I am capable of, and I know what I am able to do on my own. And I think me coming into, my goal is to not be replaceable. Mm. That's my goal. Mm-hmm. You might be able to have somebody sit in this chair, but can they have an organization like I do in Box? Can they have a project management structure like I do in Airtable? Can they edit videos like I do? Do they understand the audio that gets played in the headphones of our student athletes? Do they have the relationships with our student athletes, with our admins? Can they chat? Can you chat? Or do you just sit in your office all day and work, work, work? Back to Rihanna. You know, like, can you navigate the space? Because if you can't navigate, you will get, you will be hurt. You will, bandwidth will be cut, and you just won't have fun. So have fun, enjoy it, but take the lessons and learn from them. Ask the right questions. Don't ask, how do I get there? Ask me how I stay organized. Mm. Ask me what editing tool I'm using. Ask me how I was able to go in this room and ask the right questions. Because that's more important than trying to be the best graphic designer, videographer. You will be replaced. You will be replaced.
I love everything that you just said.
Me too.
Awesome. And to add on to that, it's like, if you're thinking about being, you know, full-time freelancer or business owner, that's the one thing, that's the biggest adjustment that I'm really learning, and I've been doing this for 3 years, is that in those spaces, you may be a, you know, a Swiss Army knife, because that's what everybody's looking for, somebody that can do it all. Or you may just be a videographer or a producer or editor or a graphic designer or a motion designer. Is that all you know how to do is a skill? Because even when you become like an assistant AD, there are meetings that you have to go through, and there's the day to day. Do you have an admin that can take some of that off of you, that can, you know, get, do you have the accountant that can do all the accounting? Do you have this person that can do all that? Or are you just the skill? Because people will pay for just the skill, but then people will also pay more for the structure and strategy and something that can bring even more value. One video, yeah, it's cool. It has a shelf life. It may go viral. But if you're pushing a strategy that can give them time back, they will pay more for that. And so I think that it is imperative that we start diving deeper into what we really want, and not just, I'm tired of taking orders from Justin because he doesn't know what he's doing. I know what I'm doing. There's a reason behind every decision. I've worked for people who really did know what they were doing, and I worked for people who really did not know what they were doing. And it's easy to identify. They will tell on themselves, but they're there for a reason. Right? They may be really good at structure. They may be really good at just sitting in meetings and being a yes person. They may be the type of person that can really put everyone in place, but they don't know how to do the skill. When I was coming up through the ranks, it's like, oh man, they don't know how to do this. And like, they're not the ones that are doing it. But Henry Ford wasn't putting cars together himself either. He was the brain behind it. And so there's value in people who aren't doing the hands-on work. And so we can't get caught up in, you know, who can and can't do the work. There's going to, like, now you have business owners who are using people, you know, three continents over doing work for them, but they're able to kind of put that master plan together. So, you know, it's a lot to it, but this has been really great conversation on a lot of different topics. And I love that we were able to get you on to kind of walk through a lot of that different stuff, because, you know, it's, this podcast will always, to me, will always be a space where no matter who we have on, there's something that somebody can take away. So as much as we like to spotlight people, in that spotlight, there's lessons too. So definitely want to thank you for hopping on with us. And we got to take that trip to Lafayette.
Let's do it.
We got to take Karina's video of all of her reactions. And just,
oh, yeah. We should make a reel out of that.
That's what I'm laughing at over here.
Oh, no. Oh, jeez.
Can I add one last thing?
Yes.
I think being from New York and kind of helped me, aided me in that as well, because I grew up, I was in the era where everybody had a camera, at least a DSLR, and everybody was uploading to YouTube. Execution is the biggest thing in the world. When you get around people, don't be starstruck. Just treat them like regular people. Do your job. Don't get out of line. Don't get out of place. But do not be a struggling artist. You have to be organized. You have to be efficient. You have to execute. The people that are great artists are struggling artists because they don't do those three things. If you can't sell your product, and you need to know, hey, when I hire people, when I hired the team here at Tulane, the few that I did get to hire, if you love butterflies, we're sports. We don't add butterflies to our video. Go shoot butterflies on your own time, but do what makes you happy. Continue to make that product because you love that. Go shoot the butterflies over there. But while we're here, let's create what we create one over here and continue to do your own thing, because this is not the end all be all. Go make your movie. Go write your short film. Go create your podcast. And I'm telling myself this stuff too, because I got this stuff I want to do. Mm-hmm. But am I, you know, it's a lot. It's a lot. So take your time, but be organized, please. Be able to find that piece of paper where you took your notes down from that meeting call that you had and transmit it into someplace else. Figure out about Airtable, Notion, Rike. It's 1,000 of them.
Asana, yeah.
Big Asana.
Yeah.
Basecamp.
Monday.com.
Workfront.
Trello.
Adobe Workfront.
No Adobe.
No Adobe products, please. Please, no cameras.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. Special thanks to APM for providing the music used in the podcast today. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're not a member and would like to join, go to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.